This time it's going to be different. There will be 10,000 dead. There aren't even that many people in the whole country, he said, laughing. The cataclysm began at 4 o'clock in the morning. Clara woke a little before it, having had an apocalyptic nightmare of exploded horses, cows hurled into the sea, people crawling under stones, and gaping caverns in the earth into which whole houses were falling. She rose livid with terror and ran to Blanca's room. But as she did every night, Blanca had locked her door and slipped out the window in the direction of the river. The last few days before returning to the city, her summer passion took on a dramatic quality, and with a new separation imminent, the two young people seized every possible opportunity to give free rein to their desires. They spent the nights at the river, immune to their weariness and the cold, thrashing with the strength of their desperation, and only as the first glimpse of dawn came through the clouds did Blanca return to the house and climb through her bedroom window, falling into bed, just as the first cocks crowed. Clara arrived at her daughter's door and tried to open it, but it was bolted. She knocked, and when no one opened it, she turned and ran outside the house where she saw the window wide open and Ferula's hydrangeas trampled. In a flash, she understood the color of Blanca's aura, the bags under her eyes, her listlessness, her silence, her morning sleepiness, and her afternoon watercolors. And in that instant, the earthquake began. Clara felt the ground shake and was unable to keep her footing. She fell to her knees. The tiles on the roof gave way and crashed around her with a deafening roar. She saw the adobe walls of the house crumple as if they had been chopped with an axe. And then the earth opened just as she had seen it in her dream, and an enormous crevice formed before her, swallowing the chicken coops, the laundry troughs, and part of the stable. The water tank swayed from side to side and smashed to the ground, spilling 1,000 gallons of water on the few surviving hens, who flapped their wings desperately. In the distance, the volcano began to shoot flames and smoke like a furious dragon. The dogs broke loose from their chains and raced madly up and down. The horses that had survived the collapse of the stable stomped the air and neighed in terror before bolting off into the open fields. The poplars teetered like drunks and fell with their roots in the air, crushing the swallows' nests. Most terrible of all was the roar coming from the center of the earth, that hard-breathing giant that was heard at length, filling the air with fear. Clara tried to drag herself toward the house, calling Blanca's name, but the death-rattling shutters of the earth prevented her from moving. She saw the peasants running out of their houses, terrified, imploring heaven, throwing their arms around each other, pulling their children, kicking their dogs, pushing their old people, and trying to salvage their few poor belongings in that din of brick and tile flying from the very bowels of the earth, like an interminable noise of the end of the world. Esteban Trueba appeared in the doorway at the very instant when the house snapped in half like an eggshell and collapsed in a cloud of dust, flattening him beneath a pile of rubble. Clara pulled herself to where he was, shouting his name, but there was no reply. The first tremor of the earthquake lasted nearly a minute and was the strongest that had ever been recorded in that country of catastrophes. It leveled almost everything that stood, and whatever was left was finished off in the string of secondary tremors that continued to shake the world until the sun came up. At Tres Marias, they waited till daybreak to count the dead and dig out those who had been buried alive beneath the avalanche, many of whom were still moaning, among them Esteban Trueba, whose location was known to everyone, although no one expected him to be alive. It took 4 men under Pedro Segundo's guidance to remove the hill of dust, tile, and adobe that had fallen on top of him. Clara had lost her angelic distraction and was helping to remove the stones with the strength of a man. We have to get him out. He's still alive and he can hear us, Clara assured them, and that gave them the courage to continue. Blanca and Pedro III appeared at first light, unhurt. Clara hurled herself at her daughter and slapped her on the face, but then she embraced her tearfully, relieved to know she was alive and to have her by her side. Your father's in there, Clara cried, pointing. The young people joined in, and after an hour, when the sun was already shining on that anguished landscape, they lifted the patron from his tomb. He had so many broken bones that they could not be counted, but he was alive, and his eyes were open. We have to take him into town to see a doctor, said Pedro II. They were discussing how to transport him without his bones popping through his skin like a broken bag, when old Pedro Garcia came up. Thanks to his blindness and his age, he had survived the earthquake without getting upset. He bent down beside the wounded man, feeling him with his hands, looking with his ancient fingers, until there was not an inch he had not covered or a bone he had not felt. If you move him, he'll die, he concluded. Esteban Trueba was still conscious, and he heard the words quite clearly. He remembered the ant plague and decided that the old man was his only hope. He knows what he's doing, he stammered. Pedro Garcia had a blanket brought, and, between his son and his grandson, they laid the patron on it, lifted him carefully, and raised him onto an improvised table that they had set up in what was formerly the courtyard, but was now no more than a small clearing in that nightmare of debris, animal corpses, crying children, moaning dogs, and praying women. They had rescued a wineskin from among the ruins, which Pedro Garcia divided three ways, a third to wash the injured man's body, a third for Esteban to drink, and the other third he drank parsimoniously himself before beginning to set Esteban's bones, one by one, patiently and calmly, pulling here, adjusting there, putting each one back in its proper place, splinting them, wrapping them in strips of sheet to keep them immobile, mumbling litanies to the healing saints, invoking good luck and the Virgin Mary, and putting up with the screams and blasphemies of Esteban Trueba without ever altering his beatific blind man's expression. By touch, he restored the body so perfectly that the doctors who examined Trueba afterward could not believe such a thing was possible. I wouldn't even have tried, said Dr. Cuevas when he heard what had happened. The destruction from the earthquake plunged the country into a long period of mourning. It was not enough that the earth shook until everything was flung to the ground. The sea drew back for several miles and returned in a single gigantic wave that sent boats to the top of mountains far from the coast, removed whole villages, roads, and animals, and submerged a number of southern islands more than a foot below the surface. Buildings fell like wounded dinosaurs. Others collapsed like a house of cards. The dead numbered in the thousands, and there was not a single family that had not lost one of its own. The salt water from the sea ruined the crops, and fires razed whole regions of cities and towns. Finally, lava began to flow, and as a crowning punishment, ash fell on the villages close to the volcano. People stopped sleeping in their houses, terrified at the thought that such a disaster could recur. Improvising tents in open spaces or sleeping in the middle of squares and streets. Soldiers had to take control of the chaos. They shot anyone they caught stealing, because while the faithful crowded into the churches begging forgiveness for their sins and beseeching God to stay his fury, thieves were running through the ruins, slicing off ears with earrings and fingers with rings, not stopping to ascertain whether the victims were dead or only trapped in the cave-in. A wave of germs was unleashed, causing all sorts of epidemics across the country. The rest of the world, too busy with another war, barely noticed that nature had gone berserk in that remote corner of the globe. But even so, shiploads of medicine, blankets, food, and building material arrived, all of which disappeared in the mysterious labyrinths of various bureaucracies and were still available for purchase years later. When canned vegetables from the United States and powdered milk from Europe could be bought in the most exclusive stores at the same price as any other gourmet food. Esteban Trueba spent 4 months wrapped in bandages, stiff as a board from splints, patches, and hooks, in a dreadful torment of itching and immobility, and consumed by impatience. His character deteriorated to the point where no one could stand him. Clara stayed in the country to look after him, and when communication was restored and things began to return to order, they sent Blanca to her convent school as a boarder, because her mother could not be responsible for her. In the capital, the earthquake caught Nana in her bed, and even though it was not as strong as in the south, the fright killed her just the same. The big house on the corner creaked like a walnut, its walls filled with cracks, and the huge crystal chandelier in the dining room fell to the floor, ringing like 1,000 bells, breaking to smithereens. Aside from that, the only serious effect was the death of Nana. When the fear of the first moment had passed, the rest of the servants realized that the old woman had not run out into the street with the others. They went in to look for her and found her in her cot. Her eyes popped out, and the little hair she had left standing on end in sheer terror. Because of the ensuing chaos, they were unable to give her a proper funeral as she would have wished, and were forced to bury her in a hurry without speeches or tears. None of the many children she had raised with so much love attended her funeral. The earthquake signaled such an important change in the life of the Trueba family that from then on, they divided all events into before and after that day. In Tres Marias, Pedro Segundo Garcia once again assumed the post of foreman, since the owner was unable to get out of bed. To him fell the job of organizing the workers, restoring order, and reconstructing the wreckage of the entire property. They began by burying their dead in the graveyard at the foot of the volcano, which had miraculously escaped the wave of lava that had run down the sides of the evil mountain. The new tombs gave a festive air to the pathetic little graveyard, and they planted rows of birches so there would be shade for those who came to visit their dead. They rebuilt the little brick houses one by one, exactly as they were before, along with the stables, the dairy, and the granary. Then they prepared the earth for planting, thankful that the lava and ash had fallen on the other side, sparing the property. Pedro III had to give up his excursions into town because his father needed him to help in the work. He came unwillingly, letting his father know that he was breaking his back to restore the patron's wealth while the rest of them would remain as poor as they had been before. "That's the way it's always been, son. You can't change the law of God," his father would reply. "Yes, you can, Papa. There are people doing it right now, but we don't even get the news here. Important things are happening in the world," Pedro III countered, following up with the speech of the communist teacher, or Father José Dulce María. Pedro II did not reply and continued working without pause. He looked the other way when his son, taking advantage of the patron's injury, broke the grip of censorship and introduced into Tres Marias the forbidden pamphlets of the Unionists, the teachers' political newspapers, and the strange biblical interpretations of the Spanish priest. On orders from Esteban Trueba, his foreman began to reconstruct the main house exactly as it had been before. The old men did not even change the adobe walls for modern bricks or modify the narrow windows. The only improvement was the addition of hot water in the bathrooms and the replacement of the old wood stove by a kerosene device, to which, however, no cook ever managed to adjust, and which ended up in the middle of the courtyard as a plaything for the hens. While the house was being built, they erected a shelter of wooden planks with a zinc roof, where they settled Esteban in his sick bed. From there, through a window, he could watch the work progressing and shout his instructions, boiling with rage at his protracted immobility. Clara changed enormously during those months. She had to work closely with Pedro Segundo Garcia at the task of saving what they could. For the first time in her life, she took charge of material things without any help, for she could no longer rely on her husband, on Férula, or on Nana. She awoke from a long childhood in which she had always been protected and surrounded by attention and comforts with no responsibilities. Esteban Trueba became convinced that everything he ate disagreed with him, except what she prepared for him herself. So she spent a good part of the day standing in the kitchen, plucking chickens to make invalid soup and kneading bread. She had to be his nurse, washing him with a sponge, changing his bandages, removing his bedpans. Every day, he grew more irate and despotic, ordering her, "Put my pillow here. No, higher up. Bring me wine. No, I said white wine. Open the window. Close it. This hurts. I'm hungry. I'm hot. Scratch my shoulder. Lower." Clara came to fear him far more than she had when he was a healthy, strong man who disrupted her peaceful life with his scent of the eager male, his hurricane voice, his relentless warfare, and his pompous airs, imposing his will and shattering his whims against the delicate balance she tried to keep between the spirits of the hereafter and the needy souls of the here and now. She came to despise him. As soon as his bones knit and he could be moved a little, Esteban felt the torturous desire to embrace her. Every time she stood beside him, he grabbed at her, confusing her in his invalid's disturbed state of mind with the robust peasant women who in his early days had served him in both kitchen and bed. Clara felt that she was too old for that sort of thing. Misfortune had spiritualized her, and age and her lack of love for her husband had led her to think of sex as a rather crude form of amusement that made her joints ache and knocked the furniture around. Within a few hours, the earthquake had brought her face to face with violence, death, and vulgarity, and had put her in touch with the basic needs to which she had been oblivious. Her three-legged table and her capacity to read tea leaves were useless in protecting the tenants from epidemics and disorder, the earth from drought and snails, the cows from foot and mouth disease, the chickens from distemper, the clothing from moths, her children from abandonment, and her husband from death and his own rage. Clara was tired. She felt alone and confused. And when it came time to make decisions, the only person she could turn to was Pedro Segundo Garcia. That loyal, silent man was always there, within reach of her voice, providing a certain stability in the midst of the catastrophe that had shaken her life. At the end of the afternoon, Clara would often look for him to give him a cup of tea. They sat beneath the eaves in wicker chairs, waiting for night to come and relieve the tension of the day. They watched the darkness fall softly, and the first stars began to twinkle in the sky, listened to the croaking of the frogs, and kept their silence. They had much to say to each other, many problems to resolve, many agreements pending, but they both understood that that half hour spent in silence was a well-deserved reward. They sipped their tea slowly to make it last, and each thought of the other's life. They had known each other for more than 15 years and had spent their summers in proximity. But in all that time, they had exchanged only a handful of sentences. He had seen her as a luminous summer apparition, removed from the brutal demands of the world, different from all other women he had known. Even then, with her hands sunk in the dough or her apron bloody with the chicken to be served at lunch, she struck him as a sort of ghost in the reverberation of the day. Only at dusk, in the calm of those moments shared over a cup of tea, could he see her human side. He had secretly sworn her his loyalty, and, like an adolescent, there were times when he fantasized about giving his life for her. He valued her as much as he detested Esteban Trueba. When the men came to install a telephone, the house still had a long way to go before it could be lived in. Esteban Trueba had been fighting to get one for 4 years, and they delivered it just when he did not even have a roof to protect it from inclement weather. The apparatus did not last very long, but it was useful for calling the twins and listening to them talk as if they were in another galaxy, amid the deafening roar and the interruptions of the operator in town, who participated in their conversations. By telephone, they learned that Blanca was ill, and that the nuns did not want to be responsible for her. She had a persistent cough and frequent attacks of fever. The dread of tuberculosis was in every home then, because there was not a family that had not lost one of its members to consumption, so Clara decided to go and fetch her. The same day Clara was leaving, Esteban Trueba smashed the phone to bits with his cane because it was ringing, and though he shouted that he was coming, that it should be still, the machine continued ringing, and in a fit of rage, he fell on top of it, showering it with blows and in the process breaking the clavicle that old Pedro Garcia had taken so much trouble to restore. It was the first time Clara had ever traveled by herself. She had made the same trip year after year, but always inattentively because there was someone else to worry about the mundane details while she dreamily watched the landscape out the window. Pedro Segundo Garcia took her to the station and helped her to her seat. When she said goodbye, she leaned over, kissed him gently on the cheek, and smiled. He pressed his hand to his face to protect that fleeting kiss, and he did not smile, because he was filled with sadness. Guided more by her intuition than by her knowledge of things or by logic, Clara managed to reach her daughter's school without mishap. The Mother Superior received her in her Spartan office, where there was an immense, bloody Christ on the wall and an incongruous spray of red roses on the table. "We've sent for the doctor, Señora Trueba," she said. "There's nothing wrong with the child's lungs, but nevertheless, you'd better take her. The country air will do her good. We simply can't assume responsibility for her. I'm sure you understand." The nun rang a little bell, and Blanca appeared in the doorway. She looked thinner and paler, with violent rings around her eyes that would have been enough to startle any mother. But Clara quickly understood that her daughter's illness was not in her body, but in her soul. The hideous gray uniform made her look much younger than she really was, despite the fact that her womanly curves showed through the design. Blanca was surprised to see her mother, whom she remembered as a light-hearted, absent-minded angel dressed in white, transformed into an efficient woman with calloused hands and two deep lines at the corners of her mouth. They went to see the twins at school. It was the first time they had all been together since the earthquake, and they were surprised to find that the only part of the country unscathed by the disaster was that ancient institution, where the event had been ignored completely. The country's 10,000 dead had gone unmourned and uneulogized, while the boys went on singing English songs and playing cricket, moved only by reports that reached them, 3 weeks late, from the British Isles. The women were astonished to discover that these two boys, whose veins flowed with Moorish and Spanish blood, and who were born in the farthest depths of the Americas, now spoke Spanish with an Oxford accent, and that the only emotion they were capable of expressing was surprise, raising their left eyebrows. They had nothing in common with the two energetic, lice-infested boys who spent their summers in the country. "I hope all that Anglo-Saxon phlegm doesn't turn you into morons," Clara said as she bade her sons goodbye. The death of Nana, who despite her age was in charge of the big house on the corner when the owners were away, sent the remaining servants into disarray. Without her vigilance, they neglected their duties and began to spend their time in an orgy of siestas and gossip, while the plants went dry for lack of watering, and spiders filled the dusty corners of the house. The deterioration was so obvious that Clara decided to shut the house and dismiss everyone. Then she and Blanca set about the task of covering all the furniture in sheets and blanketing the house with mothballs. One by one, they opened the bird cages, and the sky filled with parakeets, canaries, lovebirds, and finches, which flew around in circles, blinded by their sudden freedom, and finally took off in every direction. Blanca noticed that in the course of all these chores, not a single ghost appeared from behind the curtains. Not a single Rosicrucian arrived on a tip from his sixth sense. Nor did any starving poet come running in, summoned by necessity. Her mother seemed to have become an ordinary, down-to-earth woman. "You've changed, Mama," Blanca said. "It's not me who's changed," her mother replied. "It's the world." Before they left, they went to Nana's room in the servants' quarters. Clara opened her drawers, removed the cardboard suitcase that the good woman had used for 50 years, and went through her wardrobe. There was just a handful of clothing, a few old sandals, and boxes of every shape and size tied with bits of ribbon or elastic, in which she kept engraved announcements of first communions and baptisms, locks of hair, fingernails, discolored photographs, and a few pairs of well-worn baby shoes. They were her souvenirs of all the Del Valle and Trueba children she had cradled in her arms. Under the bed, they found a bundle that contained the costumes Nana had used to frighten Clara in her years of silence. Seated on the cot, with these treasures in her lap, Clara wept for a long time for this woman who had devoted her entire life to making that of others more agreeable, and who had died alone. "After trying so hard to frighten me to death, she's the one who died of fright," Clara observed. They had the body transferred to the Del Valle family tomb in the Catholic cemetery, because they knew she would not have liked being buried among Protestants and Jews, and that in death she would have wanted to remain side by side with those she had served in life. They placed a spray of flowers by her grave and left for the station, where they would catch the train back to Tres Marias. During the train ride, Clara brought her daughter up to date on the state of the family and her father's health, expecting that Blanca would ask the one question she knew she wanted to ask. But Blanca did not mention Pedro Tercero García, and Clara was not bold enough to do so herself. She believed that by giving problems a name, they tended to manifest themselves, and then it was impossible to ignore them. Whereas if they remained in the limbo of unspoken words, they could disappear by themselves with the passage of time. Pedro Segundo was waiting for them at the station with the car, and Blanca was surprised to hear him whistling all the way to Tres Marias because he had such a taciturn reputation. They found Esteban Trueba sitting in a chair upholstered with blue felt, to which a set of bicycle wheels had been attached while he waited for the arrival of the wheelchair that they had ordered from the city and that Clara had brought with her luggage. He was running the house with energetic stabs of his cane and his usual panoply of insults, and was so absorbed in his duties that when they arrived, he greeted them with an indifferent kiss and forgot to ask after his daughter's health. That night, they dined at a rustic table made of planks, their meal lit by a kerosene lamp. Blanca saw her mother serve the food on plates of handcrafted clay, such as was used for making bricks, since all the dishes had perished in the quake. Without Nana to run the kitchen, things had been simplified to the point of frugality. Their meal consisted of lentil soup, bread, cheese, and quince jelly, which was less than Blanca ate at school on meatless Fridays. Esteban said that as soon as he could stand on his two feet, he would go in person to the city to buy better, more refined furnishings for the new house. He was sick and tired of living like a peasant, just because of the wild, hysterical character of this godforsaken country of theirs. All Blanca remembered of the conversation was that he had fired Pedro III Garcia with the warning that he not set foot on the property again, because he had caught him spreading communist ideas among the tenants. The girl went pale when she heard this, spilling the contents of her spoon on the tablecloth. Clara was the only one to notice the change in her expression, since Esteban was absorbed in his usual monologue about the ingrates who bite the hand that feeds them, all because of those goddamn politicians like that new socialist candidate, a real nincompoop, who has the nerve to ride up and down the country in his shabby little train, stirring the people up with his Bolshevik ideas. He'd better keep away from here if he knows what's good for him, because we'll make mincemeat of him. We're ready and waiting. There's not an owner for miles around who doesn't feel the same way I do. We're not letting anyone in here to start preaching against honest work. The reward for work well done. The reward for those who meet life head on. You can't expect the weak to have the same as those of us who've worked from sun up to sundown and know how to invest our money, run risks, and take on responsibilities. Because when you get right down to it, the land belongs to those who work it, which is going to boomerang on them because the only one who knows how to work around here is me. Without me, this place would have been a wreck and stayed one. Not even Jesus Christ said we have to share the fruits of our labors with the lazy. And that little shit, Pedro III, dares to say that on my land. The only reason I didn't shoot him through the eyes is because I respect his father, and because you could say I owe my life to his grandfather. But I warned him that if I caught him prowling around here, I'd blow his brains out. Clara took no part in the conversation. She was too busy putting things on the table and taking them away, and keeping an eye on her daughter. But as she removed the soup bowl with the leftover lentils, she caught the final words of her husband's harangue. "You can't keep the world from changing, Esteban," she said. "If it's not Pedro III Garcia, someone else will bring new ideas to Tres Marias." Esteban Trueba brought his cane down on the soup tureen his wife had in her hands and knocked it to the floor, splattering its contents. Blanca jumped to her feet in horror. It was the first time she had seen her father's temper turned against her mother. She expected Clara to enter one of her moonstruck trances and exit through the window. But nothing of the sort took place. Clara picked up the broken pieces of tureen with her usual aplomb, not showing any signs that she was listening to the stream of curses issuing from Esteban's lips. She waited for him to finish, wished him good night with a gentle kiss on the cheek, and left the room, taking Blanca by the hand. Blanca did not let Pedro III's absence disturb her. She went to the river every day and waited. She knew that sooner or later, word of her return to Tres Marias would reach the boy, and that the call of love would overtake him no matter where he was. And so it happened. On the fifth day, she saw a tramp in a winter poncho and a broad-brimmed hat coming toward her, pulling a burro weighed down with kitchen utensils, pewter pots, copper teapots, huge enameled casseroles, and ladles of all shapes and sizes, with a jangle of tin cans that heralded his arrival 10 minutes in advance. She did not recognize him. He looked like an impoverished old man, one of those sad wandering souls who travel the provinces hawking their wares from door to door. He stopped in front of her and took off his hat. And then she saw the beautiful black eyes shining between a disheveled head of hair and a rough beard. The burro continued nibbling grass with its burden of noisy pots and pans, while Blanca and Pedro III slaked the accumulated hunger and thirst of the long months of silence and separation, rolling among the rocks and brush and moaning passionately. Afterward, they sat embracing among the rushes on the riverbank. Amid the buzz of the dragonflies and the croaking of the frogs, she told him how she had put banana peels and blotting paper in her shoes so she would develop a fever, and had drunk ground chalk until she got a genuine cough to convince the nuns that her lack of appetite and her pallor were the unmistakable symptoms of tuberculosis. "I wanted to be with you," she said, kissing him on the neck. Pedro III talked to her about what was going on in the rest of the world and in the country, about the distant war that had sent half of humanity into a hail of shrapnel and an agony of concentration camps and produced a flood of widows and orphans. He spoke of the workers of Europe and the United States, whose rights were respected because the slaughter of organizers and socialists of the preceding decades had led to laws that were more just and republics that were governed properly, where the rulers did not steal powdered milk sent from abroad to the victims of disasters. "The peasants are always the last to understand. We don't know what's going on in other parts of the world," he said. "They hate your father here, but they're so afraid of him that they can't organize. You understand, Blanca?" She understood, but right then she was interested in inhaling his scent of fresh grain, kissing his ears, running her fingers through his thick beard, and listening to his enamored moans. She was also afraid for him. She knew that not only would her father shoot the promised bullet into his head, but that any of the owners in the region would gladly do the same. Blanca reminded Pedro III of the story of the socialist leader who a few years earlier had bicycled across the province, distributing pamphlets on the haciendas and organizing the tenants until the Sanchez brothers caught him, beat him to death, and hanged him from a telephone pole at the intersection of two roads where everyone could see him. There he had hung for a day and a half, swinging against the sky, until the mounted police arrived and cut him down. To cover up the affair, they accused the Indians on the reservation, even though everybody knew that they were peaceful and that anyone afraid to kill a chicken would hardly kill a man. But the Sanchez brothers dug him up from the cemetery and hauled the body out into full view. And then it was too much to attribute to the Indians. Still, despite the evidence, the law would not intervene, and the death of the socialist was quickly forgotten. "They could kill you," Blanca pleaded, embracing him. "I'm careful," Pedro III assured her. "I don't stay too long in the same place. That's why I won't be able to see you every day. Wait for me right here. I'll come whenever I can." "I love you," she told him, weeping.
"I love you too."
They hugged with the insatiable passion of their youth, while the burro went on chewing grass. Blanca managed not to be sent back to school by making herself nauseated with hot brine, giving herself diarrhea from eating green plums, and bringing herself to the point of exhaustion by tightly fastening a horse's girth around her waist until she had acquired a reputation of sickliness, which was precisely what she wanted. She had learned to imitate the symptoms of various illnesses so well that she could have fooled a whole committee of physicians. She even convinced herself that she had a most delicate constitution. Every morning, as soon as she woke up, she ran her mind over her body to see where she hurt and what new afflictions she had developed. She learned to take advantage of the slightest excuse for feeling ill, from a change in temperature to a shift in the pollen count, and to transform the least ache or pain into a full-blown agony. In Clara's view, the best thing for one's health was to keep one's hands busy. So she kept her daughter's illness in line by making her work. The girl had to awaken early like everybody else, take a cold bath, and do her chores, which included teaching in the schoolhouse, sewing in the workshop, and seeing to all the work of the infirmary, from giving enemas to suturing wounds with a needle and thread from the sewing basket. with no reprieve when she fainted at the sight of blood or broke out in a cold sweat when she had to wipe up someone's vomit. Old Pedro Garcia, who was nearly 90 and could barely drag his bones from one place to another, shared Clara's notion that hands were meant to be used. This is why one day, when Blanca was complaining of a terrible migraine, he called her and, without warning, dropped a ball of clay into her lap. He spent that afternoon teaching her how to shape the clay into pieces of kitchen crockery, and the girl forgot all about her pains. The old man could not know that he was giving Blanca something that would later be her only means of survival, as well as her sole comfort in the sad hours to come. He taught her how to move the wheel with her foot while her hands flew across the moistened clay to make vases and jugs. But Blanca soon discovered that she was bored making utilitarian objects, and that it was far more amusing to make statues of animals and people. In time, she created a whole miniature world of household animals and people engaged in every trade. Carpenters, laundresses, cooks, each with his or her own tiny tools and furniture.
"This isn't good for anything," Esteban Trueba said when he saw his daughter's output.
"Let's find a use for it," Clara suggested. Thus was born the idea of the creches. Blanca began to create tiny figures for the family's Christmas manger. Not only the three kings and the shepherds, but a whole crowd of every kind of people and every type of animal. African camels and zebras, American iguanas and Asian tigers, without worrying about the exact fauna of Bethlehem. Afterward, she added imaginary animals, gluing half an elephant to half a crocodile without realizing that she was doing in clay what her Aunt Rosa, whom she never knew, had done with thread on her enormous tablecloth. Clara decided that if craziness can repeat itself in a family, then there must be a genetic memory that prevents it from being swallowed by oblivion. Blanca's multitudinous creches became a tourist attraction. She had to train two girls to help her because she was unable to keep up with the orders. That year, everybody wanted one of her creches, especially since she did not charge for them. Esteban Trueba concluded that her mania for clay was fine as a form of amusement for a proper young lady, but that if it became a business, the name of Trueba would be brought down to the level of those merchants who sold nails in the hardware stores and fried fish in the market. Blanca's meetings with Pedro III became infrequent, but for that very reason, they were all the more intense. During those years, she grew accustomed to sudden starts and protracted waits. She resigned herself to the idea that they would always have to make love on the sly, and she stopped nursing the dream of getting married and living in one of her father's small brick houses. Often, whole weeks went by without her having any news of him, but then suddenly, a mailman on a bicycle would appear at the hacienda, or a Protestant preacher with a Bible tucked under his arm, or a gypsy speaking some half-pagan tongue, all of them so inoffensive that they entered the grounds without arousing the suspicion of the ever-watchful eye of the owner. She recognized Pedro III by his pitch-black eyes. Nor was she the only one. The tenants at Tres Marias and many peasants from haciendas across the region also waited for him. Ever since the young man had been chased away by the owner, he had become a hero. Everyone wanted the honor of hiding him for the night. The women wove him ponchos and winter socks, and the men saved him their best brandy and the best dried beef of the season. His father, Pedro II Garcia, suspected that his son was breaking Trueba's prohibition and could well imagine the tracks he left behind. He was torn between his love for his son and his role as guardian of the hacienda. He was also afraid he might recognize him and that Esteban Trueba would read it on his face, but he secretly rejoiced at the thought that his son was behind some of the unusual things that were taking place throughout the countryside.
The only thing that never crossed his mind was that his son's visits might have something to do with Blanca Trueba's outings by the river, because that possibility was simply not within the natural scheme of things. He never spoke of his son, except within the privacy of his own family, but he was proud of him and preferred to see him as a fugitive than as one more of the peasants, planting potatoes and harvesting poverty like everybody else. When he heard other people humming the song about the hens and fox, he would smile at the thought that his son had made more converts with his subversive ballads than with the Socialist Party pamphlets he so tirelessly distributed.
6. Revenge. A year and a half after the earthquake, Tres Marias was once again the model estate it had been before. The main house was the equal of the old one, but it was sturdier and had hot water in the bathrooms. The water was like light chocolate, and sometimes there were even tadpoles in it, but it poured out in a strong, cheerful gush. The German pump was a wonder. I went everywhere with only a thick silver cane for support, the same one I use today. My granddaughter says I don't need it. She says I only use it to emphasize my words. My long illness damaged my body and worsened my disposition. I admit that by the end, even Clara couldn't stop my tantrums. Anyone else would have been left an invalid by that accident, but desperation gave me strength. I would think of my mother sitting in her wheelchair and rotting alive, and that gave me the tenacity to stand up and start walking, even if it was with the aid of curses. I think people were afraid of me. Even Clara, who had never dreaded my temper, partly because I was careful not to turn it against her, walked around half terrified. And seeing her that way made me frantic. Slowly but surely, Clara changed. She looked tired, and I could see that she was pulling away from me. She had no compassion for my suffering, and I realized that she was avoiding me. I would even venture to say that at the time she felt more comfortable milking the cows with Pedro Segundo than keeping me company in the sitting room. The more distant Clara became, the more I needed her love. The desire I had for her when we married had not diminished. I wanted to possess her absolutely, down to her last thought. But that diaphanous woman would float by me like a breath of air. And even if I held her down with my hands and embraced her with all my strength, I could never make her mine. Her spirit wasn't with me. When she was afraid of me, our life became a torment. During the day, we went about our business. We both had a lot to do. We met only at mealtimes, and I was the one who wound up doing all the talking because she was always in the clouds. She spoke very little, and had lost that fresh, brazen laughter that was the first thing I had liked about her. She no longer threw her head back and laughed with all her teeth showing. She barely even smiled. I thought that my age and the accident were driving us apart and that she was bored with married life, something that happens to all couples. Then, too, I was never a gentle lover, the type that brings flowers home and says a lot of sweet words. But I did what I could to get close to her. God knows I tried. I would come into her room when she was busy writing in her notebooks or working with her three-legged table. I tried to share those aspects of her life, but she didn't like anyone to read her notebooks that bore witness to life, and my presence interfered with her concentration when she was talking with her spirits, so I had to stop. I also gave up the idea of establishing a good relationship with Blanca. Ever since she was a child, my daughter had been rather strange. She was never the loving, gentle girl I would have liked to have. As a matter of fact, she was more like an armadillo. From the very beginning, she was surly with me, and she didn't have to worry about getting over any Electra complex, because she never had one. But now she was a young lady. She was intelligent and mature for her age, very close to her mother. I thought she might be able to help me, and I attempted to enlist her as an ally, buying her presents and trying to joke with her. But she eluded me too. Now that I'm very old and can talk about it without losing my head, I think her love for Pedro Tercero Garcia was to blame. Blanca could not be blackmailed. She never asked for anything. She spoke even less than her mother, and if I ever forced her to kiss me, she did it so reluctantly that it hurt me like a slap across the face. Everything will change when we return to the city and start living like civilized people again, I would tell myself back then. But neither Clara nor Blanca showed the slightest interest in leaving Tres Marias. On the contrary, every time I raised the matter, Blanca said that country life had restored her health, but that she still didn't feel strong enough. And Clara reminded me that there was still a lot to do on the hacienda, that things weren't at a point where we could leave them. My wife didn't miss the refinements she had been accustomed to, and the day the shipment of furniture and household goods I had ordered to surprise her arrived at the door, all she said was how lovely it was. I myself had to figure out where everything should go. She didn't seem to care at all. The new house was decked out with a luxury unrivaled even in those magnificent days before the place was passed down to my father, who left it a ruin. Huge colonial pieces made of blonde oak and walnut arrived, along with heavy wool carpets and lamps of hammered iron and copper. I ordered a set of hand-painted English china worthy of an embassy, a full set of glassware, 4 chests stuffed with decorations, linen sheets, and tablecloths, and a whole collection of classical and popular records with their own modern victrola. Any other woman would have been delighted with all this, and would have had her work cut out for her for months to come, but not Clara, who was impervious to these things. All she managed to do was train a couple of cooks and the daughters of 2 of our tenants to help around the house, and as soon as she was free of brooms and saucepans, she returned to her notebooks and her tarot cards. She spent most of her day busy with the sewing workshop, the infirmary, and the schoolhouse. I left her alone because those chores made her whole existence worthwhile. She was a charitable and generous woman, eager to make those around her happy. Everyone except me. After the house collapsed, we rebuilt the grocery store. And just to please her, I stopped using the slips of pink paper and began to pay my tenants with real money. Clara said that way they could also shop in town and put a little aside if they wanted. But that wasn't true. All it was good for was for the men to go get themselves dead drunk in the bar at San Lucas and for the women and children to go hungry. We had a lot of fights about that sort of thing. The tenants were the cause of all our fights. Well, not all. We also talked about the war. I used to follow the progress of the Nazi troops on a map I had hung on the drawing room wall, while Clara knitted socks for the Allied soldiers. Blanca would hold her head in her hands, not understanding how we could get so excited about a war that had nothing to do with us and that was taking place across the ocean. I suppose we also had misunderstandings for other reasons. Actually, we hardly ever agreed on anything. I don't think my bad disposition was to blame for all of it, because I was a good husband, nothing like the hothead I had been when I was a bachelor. She was the only woman for me. She still is. One day, Clara had a bolt installed on her bedroom door, and after that, she never let me in her bed again, except when I forced myself on her and when to have said no would have meant the end of our marriage. At first I thought she had one of those strange ailments women get from time to time, or else her menopause. But when it persisted for several weeks, I decided we'd better have a talk. She calmly explained that our marriage had deteriorated and that she had lost her natural inclination for the pleasures of the flesh. She had concluded that if we had nothing to say to each other, we would also be unable to share a bed. And she seemed surprised that I could spend all day being furious at her and then wish to spend the night making love. I tried to make her see that in this respect men and women are very different, and that despite all my bad habits I still adored her. But it was no use. At the time I was in better shape than she was, even with my accident, and though she was much younger. I had lost weight as I got older, and I didn't have an ounce of fat on me. I was as strong and as healthy as I'd been as a young man. I could spend the whole day horseback riding, sleep anywhere, and eat anything I felt like without having to worry about my bladder, my liver, or any of the other organs people talk about incessantly. I'll admit my bones ached. On chilly evenings or humid nights, the pain in the bones that had been crushed in the earthquake became so unbearable that I would have to bite my pillow to keep people from hearing my screams. When I couldn't take another minute, I knocked back a big swig of brandy and two aspirins, but it didn't help. The funny part of it is that although my sexuality had got more selective over time, I was almost as easily aroused as in my youth. I liked looking at women. I still do. It's an aesthetic pleasure, almost spiritual. But only Clara awakened any real desire in me, because through all the years of life together, we had learned to know each other, and we each had the exact geography of the other at our fingertips. She knew exactly where my most sensitive places were, and she could tell me exactly what I wanted to hear. At an age when most men are bored with their wives and need the stimulation of other women, I was convinced that only with Clara could I make love the way I had on my honeymoon, tirelessly. I wasn't tempted to look for anyone else. I remember starting to hound her as soon as the sun went down. In the evening, she would sit and write, and I'd pretend to be sucking on my pipe, but actually I was looking at her from the corner of my eye. As soon as she began getting ready to go to bed, she would clean her pen and shut her notebooks. I'd begin. I limped out to the bathroom, spruced myself up, and put on the plush ecclesiastic dressing gown I had bought to seduce her in, but she never seemed to notice. Then I pressed my ear to the door and waited. When I heard her coming down the hall, I jumped out ahead of her. I tried everything, from showering her with praise and gifts to threatening to knock her door down and beat her to a pulp, but none of these effects was enough to bridge the gap between us. I suppose it was useless for me to expect her to forget my sour temper of the daytime with all sorts of amorous attentions in the evening. Clara eluded me with that distracted attitude of hers I came to despise. I can't understand what it was about her that attracted me so much. She was a middle-aged woman, without a trace of flirtatiousness, who walked with a slight shuffle and had lost the unwarranted gaiety that had made her so appealing in her youth. Clara was neither affectionate nor seductive with me. I'm convinced she didn't love me. There was no reason for me to desire her so outrageously and to let myself get so carried away by her refusal. But I couldn't help it. Her slightest gesture, her faint scent of fresh laundry and soap, the light in her eyes and the grace of her delicate neck crowned with untamable curls, I loved everything about her. Her fragility made me feel the most unbearable tenderness toward her. I wanted to protect her, to clasp her in my arms, to make her laugh like the old days. I wanted to sleep with her beside me, her head on my shoulder, her legs tucked under mine, so small and warm, so vulnerable and precious, with her hand on my chest. At times, I would decide I was going to punish her by feigning indifference. But after a few days I gave up because she seemed more relaxed when I ignored her. I drilled a hole in the bathroom wall so I could watch her naked, but it got me so excited I decided to plaster it over. To hurt her feelings, I pretended I was going to the Red Lantern, but all she said was that it was a lot better than raping peasant girls, which surprised me because I didn't think she knew about that. As a result of her comments, I tried to rape again, just to see if it would get a rise out of her. But time and the earthquake had taken their toll on my virility. I no longer had the strength to grab a sturdy peasant girl by the waist and swing her up onto my saddle, much less rip her clothes off and enter her against her will. I was of an age when you need help and tenderness if you're going to make love. I was old, damn it.
He was the only one to notice that he was shrinking. He could tell from his clothes. It was not just that things fit loosely. His sleeves and his pant legs were suddenly too long. He asked Blanca to fix his clothing on her sewing machine, on the pretext that he had lost some weight,
but he wondered whether old Pedro Garcia had set his bones backward and whether that's why he was shrinking. But he did not tell a soul, just as he never talked about his pain, because it was a